Well, I'm excited to be continuing our verse-by-verse study of the book of 1 Peter. And today we're going to be in chapter 3, starting in verse 1. But before we get there, you know, I was thinking it really is important that a pastor is genuine and that what you see is what you get, that who I am in public is the same as who I am in private. So I was trying to think about a way to kind of be transparent with you guys. And then it occurred to me, you know, the way we all dress up for Zoom meetings. So what I thought I'd do today is just show you what the other side of this kitchen table looks like, the side that you normally can't see. So let's see here. Let's just do a little pan. Ah, yes, look at this lovely. So what do we got here? Well, we got lots of commentaries on 1 Peter. My highlighter, got another microphone, headphone. We got some climbing webbing. We've got salt and pepper. We've got a cloth napkin from when my kids were like 4 years old that I used for dinner last night. And let's see, we got an X-Acto knife and we have a felt protector for the bottom of a chair. We have a clamp for a tarp, and we have these guys. So that's what you got. So let me just say this about that. This looks a little better to me.
So as you can tell, we are living large at the Palmer household. I mean, we are wild. Things over here are out of control. And I hope you know me a little better now. So one more thing before we get to 1 Peter, though, that's tied to it. I want to talk about something that happened, one of the many things that happened this week, which is that Ravi Zacharias died. Now, if you were into Christian apologetics, which is the reasonable defenses of the faith, you've probably heard that name. He died of bone cancer this week. And we're going to be looking at Christian marriage today. And here's what Ravi said about it. He said, without the will, marriage is a mockery. But without emotion, it is a drudgery. You need both. And in his book on marriage, he quoted William Dougherty, who said, marriage is like being in a canoe on the Mississippi River. If you don't paddle, you head south. In other words, marriage takes a lot of work. And so if you are just passive, like that canoe, your marriage will just drift. He says, love is a commitment that will force you to make some very difficult choices. It is a commitment that demands that you deal with your lust, your greed, your power, your desire to control, your temper, your patience, and every area of temptation that the Bible so clearly talks about. Now when he was young, he was very idealistic and very romantic, and he couldn't wait to get married. And then one day, a seminary professor was talking about love and marriage, and he said, love is hard work. And Ravi didn't really like that. It seemed so cynical, so defeated. So he actually stood up and confronted the professor and said, sir, I don't really think that love is hard work. And the professor turned and looked at him and said, Zacharias, are you married? And he said, no, sir. And then he said, then sit down and be quiet because you don't know what you're talking about. Then after being married for over 30 years, Zacharias would write later, yes, love is hard work. It is the hardest work I know of, work from which you are never entitled to take a vacation. You take on budgets and cares. You inherit problems. You have to feel beyond yourself. You have to think of things other than yourself. Your responsibilities are now multiplied, and you are trusted with greater commitments. But it has everything to do with the tenderness of a heart determined to serve. So for both husband and wife, a heart determined to serve. So if you are married this morning and it feels like a lot of hard work and you look at other people and it seems like they have it so easy, No, you're not the weird one. It takes a lot of work for all of us. What if, like most accomplishments in life, a healthy marriage requires an act of the will, the tenderness of a heart determined to serve? Now that is hard work. But the emotion of joy will often come in its wake when both spouses are striving to live this way. So this morning we are going to be looking at marriages and husbands and wives, but I got to tell you that a lot of what Peter says, at first glance, like it rubs me the wrong way. Like I've got lots of question marks about how to understand the scripture we're looking at this morning. One last thing before we get to verse 1. During this pandemic, I, like a lot of you, have been watching a lot of news briefings. And because I am a leader, and so I feel a responsibility to really know what's going on, I have watched, especially in the first couple weeks, pretty much every single White House news briefing, the whole thing, including all the questions from the reporters, and also, you know, the reports, the briefings by governors and by mayors. And so, you know, we have a Republican president and we have a Democratic governor. And I got to tell you, I would watch the whole thing for either the Republican or the Democrat and then watch the news that night. And it was like I was watching a totally different news briefing. Why? Because if there was 90% of the report was good news, the reporters focused on the 10% that was bad news. If whoever was presenting 90% of the time they were articulate and did a good job, the news footage focused on the 10% where they were awkward or clumsy or messed up. And what's even worse is there were numerous times when they would edit, they would take a small section out of context for Democrat or Republican so that it seemed to mean the exact opposite of what they were saying. In other words, they cut out what came before or whatever came after, which gave you the sense and the context of what they were meaning. And it ended up making the whole thing mean the exact opposite. You got a totally different feel for the tone and the attitude of the person. Now, the reason I tell you all this is, first, because politicians come and go, but our journalists need to get their act together. I mean, we really need reform when it comes to journalism, whatever political side you're on. But the other reason I mention this to you is that that is exactly the kind of problem that can come when we cherry pick a Bible verse. In other words, if I just jumped right into chapter 3, verse 1 of Peter, and I hadn't read all the things he said up until this point, if it was just this little snippet taken out of context, almost like a piece of a news briefing taken out of context, I think I would hear him a very different way. He would come across to me as cranky, judgmental, sexist. You know, he's going to be the first pope. And so is he just sitting there on his high throne declaring and looking down on people and judging them? And is he kind of harsh and mean? But exactly because I've traveled this journey, and if you have with me too, you know, no. His tone is encouraging and friendly and kind, and it feels more to me like he's talking straight at us, like not from some high ladder or sitting on his throne, but almost like friends gathered around a table. And so, you know, whether the people were men or women, masters or slaves, rich or young, it's like they're all gathered around a table, and he's talking to them as friends, like we're all in this together. And that's your situation. Let me try and help you. That's your situation. Let me try and help you. And so as we read these verses, I hope you can hear Peter's tone and his concern and love for everyone in the church. So let's go now to 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over, without words, by the behavior of their wives. So how are we to understand this idea that wives should submit to their husbands? Or elsewhere when it says husbands should lay down their lives for their wives, does that mean wives should never lay down their lives for their husbands, or that
husbands should never submit? Well, look at why he's saying they should do this. In order to be a witness to their husbands. In other words, the wife should lead her husband. She should lead him to the Lord. She should choose to defer to him out of loyalty to God as a way of witnessing to him and pointing him to God. So as it says, without words, by the behavior of their wives, verse 2, when they see the purity and the reverence of your lives, that's going to be a witness to them that could draw them to the Lord. Okay, but what does it mean to submit? What kind of marriage does Peter have in mind? Well, it turns out that Christians are kind of divided on this. Like, there's two basic camps of how people interpret this. There's the egalitarian camp and there's the complementarian camp. And this little table is just something I made up to try and explain how I understand this. And what happens a lot of times is people go right to the implementation differences because they are different. So the egalitarian says that all decisions are made mutually or by the partner with the greater expertise, while the complementarian says assigned roles complement each other, husbands lead families, and the husband has the final say. So in other words, one of them understands this ancient hierarchy we see in ancient times and in the ancient church as something that was inherited from the culture that is not an eternal model. And so that's something that was about that time. And the other way of looking at it is, no, this idea of hierarchy is inherent in marriage. It's part of the plan, and so this approach is timeless. So often people focus on how different these approaches are, and they kind of judge each other, but what's really actually most important is the foundation that both of them are built on. Because unless this is just about you saying, I'm going to get my way, whether you're the husband or the wife, what really matters is your motive and your stance, and there's to be equal. In other words, the motive for both of these stances should be love of God and love of spouse. Why are you taking this stance? Why are you doing this? Because I love God and I will love my spouse. Okay, well then, what should your stance be? I should be willing to serve the other and not focus on my own rights or power, but on being faithful, on relying on God's empowerment. And so, that should be true whichever one of these camps you're in. So I guess my question is it true for you? Is that the foundation that you're building your relationship on? Because look at the warning I have for both of them. If you lean to the egalitarian camp, make sure that is not an excuse for a passive, selfish, irresponsible man or a haughty, domineering woman. And in the same way, if you lean more to the complementarian, the more traditional stance, make sure that's not an excuse for passive, selfish, irresponsible women or haughty, domineering men. And you might say, yeah, Langdon, but haven't we come a long way? Aren't we a much better place? Aren't we in a much better situation now than back when we were in this strict hierarchy and patriarchy? Well, yeah, in a lot of ways, absolutely, but in some ways, not so much. There was an old, oppressive, patriarchal culture. But I would argue that our current American culture is actually oppressive too. That we've swung from one extreme to the other. All right, well, what was so bad about that old culture? Well, women were treated like property or children. And they had unequal rights and there were rigid roles. Well, what's so bad about today? Well, the majority of men refuse to take responsibility for the children they father, despising the office of husband, and women overfunction. You know, we talk a lot about oppressive structures. Well, if we're going to use that term, we need to be brutally honest here. Our current setup is an oppressive structure, somewhat to women because they are overfunctioning. They're just way overfunctioning. It's all on them. And when you're trying to do two jobs,
you know, both spouses' jobs. That's kind of oppressive, but that's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about an oppressive structure for children. The truth is, if you take that small minority of fathers who are abusive or neglectful, let's put them over here, and we look at all the rest of the fathers. Statistically speaking, on average, from a purely scientific standpoint, fatherless homes, kids who are raised in the structure of a fatherless home, on average, are more likely to be poor, more likely to be involved in drug and alcohol abuse, more likely to drop out of school, more likely to suffer from physical and emotional and health problems, and boys are more likely to be involved in crime, and girls are more likely to get pregnant in their teens. Now, correlation and causation are not the same thing, but when you see how many things are correlated to a fatherless home, this is a really big deal. I mean, we're always talking about all these problems, but we like avoid the elephant in the room. That is the elephant in the room. That's the thing that's got to change. Think how many of the sorrows of the world go all the way back to a child growing up outside of a committed marriage. The problem is that we're terrible at seeing disasters unfold in slow motion, like the 18 years it takes a kid to grow up. It's time for the men in this culture to step up to the plate and be men. Now, obviously, this is not a put down of single parents. The exact opposite. I mean, some of my favorite, greatest heroes are single parents. But they're so amazing exactly because they have to deal with all this. Exactly because everything is on them and it's not fair. And they're literally trying to do all the roles that two parents would do. And I don't know how they do it. So this is not a critique of that. It's a critique of the fact that we as a culture treat marriage as just one more option of cohabitation. There's all these different ways you can cohabit, and marriage is one of them. No, marriage is a design given to us by God, and it is for the good of all. It is for the good of children. It is for the good of the parents, and it's for the good of society. So whether you end up in the egalitarian camp or you end up in the complementarian camp, the key is, in either, you've got to have this firm foundation of loving God and loving your spouse, willing to serve the other, focusing not on your own rights, but on being faithful and relying on God's empowerment. And when you treat your spouse that way, what kind of relationship does that give them? What does that give them? It gives them love, freedom, liberation, empowerment. It honors their personhood. It gives them respect. It gives them rights. So, over the last 2 weeks, Peter has been talking now about three structures in society. We looked at the structure of government. We looked at the structure of the workplace, like masters and slaves or bosses and workers. And now we're looking at structure in the family, these three institutions that really make society. And really, what's most important is today, it's the family, and then the workplace or the community, and then government. Sometimes we all act like government's the most important thing. No, family is the most important thing. So when it comes to government or workplace or even our family, what is the perfect structure? Well, the problem is, while some structures are much better than others, human sin will find its way into all of them. Some people spend their whole lives trying to create the perfect systems, the perfect structures, thinking if we can only get that right, then we'll have justice and equality in the world. No, because human sin will find its way into any structure. I'm not saying we can't make things better, but you need more than the system. You need more than the structure. And some people say, yeah, right, that's right. We do need more than just the structure. We need equality. We need the brotherhood of man. Nope, that's not enough either. Sin will find its way even into that. And if you don't believe me, just look at the history of communism in the world and the horror and the slaughter that was based on the idea that we're going to make everyone comrades. So ultimately, all the structures of society, the government, the workplace, the family, as important as they are, they're not enough. And we need something beyond the structure because actually they are secondary. All these things are secondary to the state of the human heart. What is needed beyond the structure is the human heart turned to, submitted to, empowered by, set free by a loving relationship with God. If you've been with us long, you recognize this picture up here, this iconic symbol of our church. And you also know that we say that we are not gathering around an empty space in the middle, that what's most important is the structure of the church, but rather that we are gathered around an empty tomb and a risen Lord. That is what empowers us to be the church. So now moving on to verse 3, Paul is going to get to some commands for husbands too, but first he has some for wives. And his challenge at first might sound old-fashioned, but in reality, it's actually quite liberating and it's quite anti-sin. This is what he says in verse 3. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. So when you think about it, Peter's calling women to not be superficial, to not focus on the surface, that beauty is skin deep. Well, beauty that is skin deep really isn't of that much worth. And by implication, he's saying, don't make an object of yourself. You are much more than a surface. Well, why is he making such a big deal about this? Well, have you ever seen someone who you thought was really hot? Somebody just you thought was super attractive, and you were so excited because you're thinking, man, they are so beautiful. Their soul must be beautiful too. I mean, like, how could it not be? And then you get to know them and like, oh, so gross, right? They turned out to be petty or self-absorbed or unthinking or cruel or mean. And you feel like you've been deceived. You know, Aesop said, appearances can be deceptive. And we might say, well, yeah, we all know that. But if we know that, then why do we spend so much time on our appearance? Why do we spend so much time on our surface, indicating it really is the important thing? Do you spend more time thinking about your clothes and your hair and your ornaments and your look than you spend thinking about the beauty of your own soul? And I'm talking like every day. Every day, which one do you spend more time on? Maybe this is one really good thing about this pandemic is the way people aren't spending as much time on what they look like. And I actually feel pretty good about that. You know, I talked to Ruth, my wife, recently, and I said, well, how would you describe like my look, my style? And she said, unkempt. So Peter's saying, curating the beauty of your own soul is far more important than curating your collection of clothes. And he talks about jewelry and gold, right? So is Peter saying that all jewelry is bad? I mean, how much jewelry is too much? And how would you know? Is this too much jewelry? Is this too much jewelry? Is this too much jewelry? Now, there are Christian groups who become kind of legalistic over what Peter is saying, and they say that any jewelry, any accessories, anything that draws attention to yourself is a bad thing because it leads to pride and self-absorption, and so all of us should dress exactly the same. And I get that intention, like it's a great intention, but just as they see unforeseen consequences in decorating your clothing or having jewelry, there's unforeseen consequences in being legalistic about it and trying to snuff it all out, because when you do that, you're snuffing out beauty and art and self-expression. So did Peter really intend for us to go that far? No, I don't really think he did. And again, we can get insight from what ancient Christians thought. So in the year 192 AD, that's way back, Tertullian said this about 1 Peter. Touching on modesty of dress and ornament, Peter speaks against the empty glory of apparel and the pride of gold. So it's not the uniqueness or the beauty that's the problem. In fact, in the Bible, it's clear that clothing is not just for functional use. Like there's a lot of attention, especially like with in the Old Testament, for priests' robes and what they wore. Like they're really into beauty and jewelry. So it's not so much that Peter is saying it's bad for you to stand out, but what it's saying is you need to be careful about empty glory and pride. So the question is, am I pursuing the way I dress to get everyone to look at me, to be the center of attention? Do I have dreams of walking into a room and having everyone notice me? If so, that is not the way of Jesus. That is the way of the world. And that's something totally different than really liking nice clothes. Am I intentionally dressing in a way to try and get people, not my partner, to notice how sexy I am? To reduce myself to a sexual object? That is the way of the world. That is not the way of Jesus. And notice Tertullian says pride of gold. So if I'm trying to get people to look at me and pay attention to me because I want them to notice how wealthy I am, that's just as bad as wanting them to notice how sexy I am. And I know you know I don't have a problem with that. But those two things are really the same problem. And notice that people think that it is gold that is of worth, but it's God that is saying that it's your character that is of worth. So when you have something of great worth, what does that make you? Rich, truly rich. So when am I truly rich? Not when I'm wearing fancy or expensive clothes or jewelry. I'm truly rich when I have a beautiful character. When you have a noble heart, when you are a person of character, that is riches that no one can steal. Starting in verse 5, for this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands. So if you look at the beginning of that verse, we are to put our hope in God. We are to have a gentle and quiet spirit. Verse 6, Peter now returns to the theme of verses 1 and 2 we just looked at. Like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right, and do not give way to fear. Well, why shouldn't we interpret him as saying that women should just be subservient and that their spiritual calling is to be an appendage to their husband? First, because of the context of everything we've learned from Peter up to this. Who are these wives? They are the holy. They are the chosen. They are the ones who belong. They are a royal priesthood. And second, because of how he ends the verse. Do what is right. Do not give way to fear. Well, subservience always involves fear and a sense of inferiority, but he's calling them to be proud of the long line of godly women that have come before them, to hold their heads up and not give way to fear. And what is he implying? That these women are moral agents, his peers, as fellow believers, fellow saints. And this was a radical teaching in that day. And now he's going to turn and he has a word for the husbands. They don't get off the hook either. Verse 7, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So let's go up to the top again. It says, in the same way as what? In the same way as everything that came before, out of obedience and love for God, be willing to serve other people. So how are men to view their wives? With consideration, with respect, as a partner, and as an heir. But why does it say, do all this stuff so that it won't hinder your prayers? Is it kind of like, well, just so for what you can get out of it, you ought to do that? No, I think Peter's just stating the fact of how this world works. That when you are not considerate, when you don't have respect, when you don't serve others, you become spiritually blind. Like, your prayers are hindered. Like, you don't even know what the right thing to pray for is because you're all focused on yourself. Well, what does he mean by your weaker partner? Does that mean men should view their wives as that pretty little thing that doesn't really know how to act in the world? No. He's literally talking about physical strength. And again, this is descriptive. It's not proscriptive. On average, men are bigger and stronger and have a higher muscle to mass ratio than women. So like I'm like at least 35 pounds heavier than my wife, and I'm bigger, which means if we had a wrestling match, I would probably win. Now, it literally is like my favorite sport, wrestling. And by wrestling, I mean real wrestling, not TV wrestling. In real competitive wrestling, the weight groups are split by like 6 pounds each. Like every 6 pounds, there's another weight class. Why? Because just 6 pounds of muscle can make so much difference. Well, does that mean that the bigger, heavier, stronger guy is the superior wrestler? Not at all. I might be a total hack, a total scrub with a complete losing record, and the guy 3 weight classes below me is a national champion. So Christianity is a stance against brute force. It's saying, hey, don't use your strength. Don't use what you have to rule it over somebody else. Don't use your physical strength to rule over your wife. So to sum all this up, how are husbands to treat their wives? They are to be considerate. They are to treat them with respect. They are to treat them as equal partners. They are to treat them as fellow heirs. In other words, they are to treat them as their equals. And that's how wives ought to treat their husbands too. So how can we sum up this morning? What's the takeaway? If we look at this last 2 weeks about all these structures in society and submission and serving, what's the big takeaway? Well, here's what I would say this morning. Because I belong to the royal house of God, and out of loyalty to Him, I am willing to put up with, I am willing to respect the imperfect laws and institutions of men, as long as they don't truly try to restrain my loyalty to Jesus. I am willing to submit and to serve and to suffer unfairly rather than to use the evil ways of this world to get my own way, to try and get even or use arrogance and pride and power in a wrong way. I will fight for justice and equality, but I know that I too have evil within me. So I must do this with humility, following the way of the shepherd of my soul. So guys, thanks for hanging in there with us today with a tough passage. I hope you'll be with us next week and that you'll read this next section of scripture that you can find on our website. Read that before next Sunday. It's an awesome piece. It's going to be a great time together. Amen.